taken over on the nature board. And Muda, too, it throws after him in there. Flair has won the match. But falls for Gary Hart and the great Muda. It's from the referee right out to the floor. They've got the world championship belt. Flair has won the match. Both men are a bloody mess. And with Muda and Hart in there, it was Hart who came to the ring with Terry Funk to begin the match. That was the big surprise that Funk was talking about. They're trying to hurt him. I mean, permanently
put him out. Muda was holding him.
The crowd piled around him on the chair. That'll snap his neck. That'll break his neck here. There's Dan Dillinger.
Yeah,
they have security. There's a civilian.
He got in to stop that. And then Muda gave him the karate kick.
Wait a minute. Here comes Sting. Sting is going to come to Flair's aid. Sting hammering away at Muda.
Welcome to the podcast. We said we were going to do it. We finally got around to doing it. And you should be able to download this on July 4th. And we're reviewing an awesome event tonight. The Great American Bash 1989. I'm your host, Trey Davis, alongside the professor, Andrew Stone. Andrew, how you doing tonight?
I'm good, Trey. Hope you are. Hope everybody listening is doing great, too.
All right, so what?
I'm ready to review this one.
Uh-oh. They're shooting fireworks off at my house, even though it's not July 4th, so you might hear the dogs. You might hear the dogs go off a little bit.
Okay. No big deal.
Okay. All right. Let's get into the event. All right, it was Great American Bash 1989.
Yes.
It was on July 23rd. And it drew 12,500 fans, so pretty good in Baltimore. According to Jim Cornette, that had gone down since 86. It kind of slowly started to erode, and attendance was starting to go down. And the ship was kind of sinking at the time. They just, I do believe they just got the deal with TBS a little bit before this. And it was a little chaotic, so Flair figured he could kind of right the ship, and he was your head booker along with Cornette and some other people on the booking staff. So what do you, did you do any homework as far as like what was going on behind the scenes at the time?
I mean, I've got some information as far as like some of the backstories on some of the matches.
Right.
You know, we got to remember that this is right after, if memory serves me correct, this is right after Scott Steiner came on board and started teaming with
Rick,
his brother.
Yeah, yeah. So, they were in the Battle Royal.
Yeah.
I noticed that. And Scott was kind of dressed a little bit different than normal. He didn't have a singlet on.
Well, you know, and if you look at it, that's one of the things. Yeah, that's one of the things I noticed is he was well muscled, but he was nothing like what he became.
Oh yeah,
I mean, this is way before he really started pumping in the steroids. But
yeah,
you know, he was a lot more agile.
Yeah,
this
that's
one,
what
I
was
think,
fixing
than,
to say. That
later
whole,
years,
I would say the Frankensteiner was one of my favorite moves as a kid, and Scott Steiner was just always a favorite of mine and my stepbrothers. We always appreciated his amateur style background, and I was always pulling for him to get some kind of singles run. But
absolutely.
All right, well, let's start it out. We got the $50,000 Triple Crown 2-ring King of the Hill Battle Royal. That's a mouthful. This was,
boy, isn't it though?
This was very interesting because you had to dump your opponent into the second ring, and then they had to be dumped over the top rope. It was kind of like Battle Bowl rules a little bit. Of course, this wasn't a Battle Bowl. This was a Battle Royal, and the two winners of each ring would face off, and then you'd have one winner, essentially.
Right. And, so, I mean, it was a little bit of an odd, you know, it took a little getting used to, I think, from the rule standpoint, because, you know, you see somebody, because I know just watching it, Ranger Ross is the first one to go over.
Right.
And you think, okay, he's eliminated. Oh, no, wait, he's not either. He's going into the other ring.
Right.
So that was a little, you know, like I say, it took a little getting used to.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great lineup.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, it's, it's like essentially just all Hall of Famers just about in that ring. And, I mean, like, you even see a young Scott Hall who looks like Magnum.
Right.
PA, like he's got
the
mustache going on.
The porn mustache, man.
Yeah.
And big time.
Yeah, there was you saw a lot of legends in that, and then they would compete later on. I mean, the idea isn't bad. I had a problem with the finish. Finish came at 10 minutes and 20 seconds. You had Dr. Death Steve Williams in there with Dangerous Dan Spivey. Oddly enough, I just thought, man. Okay, they're going to have Dr. Death do this because it's been so long since I've seen this event. And sure enough, he gets knocked out. I'm like, okay, well, this is interesting. You're going to have both members of the Skyscrapers face each other. But no, they didn't do that.
Well, and you got to remember that this is not very long after Teddy Long had gotten fired as a referee.
Mm-hmm.
For doing a fast count, you know, because he started getting shady as a referee.
Right.
And there was some storyline where he did a fast count against, I think it was the Road Warriors. And that was like the final straw. It was a title match, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And so he got fired. And so he came back and he took on Norman the Lunatic was his first managerial, you know, assignment,
and then
came the Skyscraper. So I think this was, whether you know, good or bad, I think it was a way for them to try and elevate the Skyscrapers to some sort of notoriety, having them walk out basically hand in hand sharing the money.
Yeah, and they were really trying to get
Teddy over as a manager at this point, who was in charge and knew what he was doing.
Right. And Teddy was a good talker. Teddy really worked his way up throughout wrestling. I mean, he started out putting up the ring, just doing anything he could to help
the
ring crew.
Sweeping the floors and stuff, yeah.
And
I thought, and you still see, and I know that I noticed, and it came to my mind that he was still a little rough on the mic, but
I thought he was excellent, he was believable enough for me, but I mean. Man,
oh, no, absolutely.
So he comes out and he tells them, you know, okay, we're going to split the 50,000 as a tag team. And there you have it. There's the result. It's the winner is, or winners are Sid and Dangerous Dan Spivey, the Skyscrapers.
Right.
And to call Teddy Long ugly would be an insult to ugly.
No argument there.
He's missing some teeth here. He's hanging on to whatever hair he can. Teddy Long. He's a better looking man today. I'll say that.
No doubt.
And
his stature did him good as he went on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean that guy. He's been around the wrestling business forever. Still around today doing indie shows. Dave Meltzer is going to give three stars, so not a bad rating from Dave Meltzer. He's kind of particular. We're going to move on to this Flying Brian versus Bill Irwin. For the life of me, I cannot remember Bill Irwin.
I'll tell you how you're going to remember him.
Okay.
He later became the Goon in the WWF.
I do remember, unfortunately.
You know, and when I saw him, I remembered him, you know, as soon as the match came on, I remembered him as kind of a mid-carder, but then I started doing a little research. He was actually a fairly successful wrestler, if you look at him, and he played a great, great heel. But I mean, if you look at him, he spent time in All Japan, Central States, Georgia Championship, Global Wrestling Federation, NWA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he won a few minor titles. I mean, he was a Brass Knucks champ. He was a national tag team champion with his brother one time in Georgia Championship Wrestling. He was the AWA Southern Heavyweight Champion. He was an NWA Central States Tag Team Champion. So, I mean, again, you know, he's not carrying around any big gold or anything, but he was a good performer. He was a good worker in the ring, and he makes Flying Brian look great. That you know,
yeah, and
he,
I think that's mainly what it was used for, was to get Brian over.
Absolutely.
And it accomplished that. It got 2.5 stars from Dave Meltzer. It was a 10-minute and 18-second long matchup. I thought it went a little too long, but, you know, for what it was worth, you know, you're trying to get Brian over. He's your new talent, and it was good. But, like I said, I went a little too long.
He got to do some high-flying stuff. Right. Agreed. And it was probably at least a couple of minutes too long.
Yeah.
You know, but the new kid, they had to get him down. They had to show that he could come back from getting a beat down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was able to come off the top rope. He was able to do some great drop kicks and some different things.
Yeah, that's what Brian. I like about talent. Brian's flying or his flying body press is that it looked real. It looks so today. It looks very smooth today. Don't get me wrong, and people do really good flying body presses, but it looks very choreographed. Whereas Brian's look like, man, this is just a guy that's flying right at you. Well, you might connect with his legs, you might connect with his stomach, like.
Right.
It looked
and
more real.
And if you remember, in this match, we've got two rings sitting next to each other. He was actually standing on top of the corner ropes in the other ring, and he jumped all the way into, you know, he jumped into the next ring to do the cross, you know, the flying body, you know, cross body.
Right.
And so, again, that just highlighted his strength and his agility and I think really helped to put him over.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, at the time, you weren't seeing a lot of that stuff that he was doing other than maybe a Rock and Roll Express matchup. So it was pretty cool to see Flying Brian that young and competing in a match. So that, you know, I thought that match was pretty good. Like I said, it went a little too long, but yeah, it served its purpose. Up next, we have the Skyscrapers versus the Dynamic Dudes. We've talked about the Dynamic Dudes before. A mirror of the 80s, I guess.
Oh,
you know.
Oh, good Lord, yes. I mean, they come out and they're throwing, you know, neon frisbees into the crowd, and they've got on their surfer shorts. And
skateboards.
You know,
it's like they've got every, like, man, 80s, like, you know,
Laurinaitis'
gimmick
mullet
you can have.
Was just...
Yeah,
Johnny Ace, you know.
Man, I sometimes forget how old Shane Douglas is and how long he's been around the business.
Yeah.
And, man,
yeah,
when he first came in, he was a top prospect.
And he absolutely was. You know, he didn't have quite as much weight on him, but he moved around the ring very, very well. And Johnny Ace, for that matter. I mean, my Lord, he's one of three Laurinaitis brothers that wrestled. You know, he was good, and they made a decent team. And again, it fit into that late 80s, early 90s, you know, persona. But yeah, Shane Douglas was, I mean, he was really good. And honestly, I hated to see them against the Skyscrapers because Sid Vicious was
very green.
I mean, he was the better of the two. I was never a Dangerous Dan Spivey fan. I always felt like he was way too clunky in the ring.
Oh, those power bombs look real. They look like they really dropped them on their necks, man. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
That's rough.
Yeah, but he just, I don't know, he looked awkward a lot in the ring. And you could just tell that some of his moves, he wasn't quite getting the timing down on them. But still, overall, I thought it was a great match.
Yeah, futurely known as Waylon Mercy in the WWF. Just a little side
there
note.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah, Dangerous Dan Spivey was Waylon Mercy. An interesting character. Skyscraper is going to pick up the win. They're pushing them pretty hard at the time. Got 1 star from Dave Meltzer, went 9 minutes and 14 seconds. A little too long, but again, it served its purpose. They didn't want to make dynamic dudes look too weak. So, you know, they gave them some offense in this match.
And you had to introduce the new team. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had to push them.
Sure.
You know, and
sure
then,
you did.
Oh, and I forgot to mention the Paul Heyman promo right before the Skyscrapers match, which was, all I have wrote down is Paul Heyman is a master on the mic.
Oh, there's no question.
Such a good manager,
man. I mean, the whole build up to this next match was, I thought, and again, we'll get to the next match. As ridiculous as it was, they built it well. The two flamboyant characters that they had going into it, and you're right, Heyman or Paulie Dangerously's promo was classic. It just absolutely was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, of course, Cornette can talk too. Both guys are probably two of the greatest talkers of all time. If Heyman can get Cornette over as a face, you know he's a pretty good talker.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So what did you think about the next match?
Well, I thought they did pretty good. And Cornette was pretty pleased with it. When I listened to his podcast, he was talking about how, you know, he had a bum knee at the time, and he's just glad he didn't go out there and embarrass himself. And the guy could throw some punches, man. Some good work punches, you know. And to Heyman's credit, Heyman sold those punches like $1 million when he's doing cartwheels in the air over a punch or two. So, I mean, I dug the match. How did you feel about it?
You know, it's a gimmick match. I mean, tuxedo match.
You know what
it. To rip the other tuxedo off the, you know. But it was great because they had so much heat with each other. You know, you're talking Midnight Express versus the original Midnight Express. And it just, you know, and like you say, with Dangerously being able to make a face out of Cornette, and at the same time, the original Midnight Express coming back on the scene and actually have people cheering for the Midnight Express Bobby Eaton and Sweet Stan.
Yeah.
You know, cause they've been booed forever and, you know, and so now it gave them a little face boost. And so I think the buildup to it was great. And the two of these guys reacting off of each other was great. Cornette, nobody really, like you say, his punches were really surprising because of the character that he played. He'd been put off as this, you know, fancy boy and all this kind of stuff, but I thought he pulled it off well, and I liked the fact that Dangerously's, you know, pulling talcum powder or whatever out of his tuxedo to, you know, blow in his face and all that kind of stuff.
But, yeah, and it
but again, for what it was, I thought it was fine.
It was 6 minutes and 22 seconds. Got a star and 3/4 from Dave Meltzer, but it is what it is. It was a gimmick match. You know what it is going into it, and it was, you know, it was good enough, and I enjoyed it. It was a nice break in the action too, where you're getting something a little different. You got to think this is before women's wrestling was big or anything, or even cruiserweight action. So this was kind of a nice little break, and it was a nice little gimmick match, and I enjoyed it.
Right.
And it's always interesting to go back and watch Cornette as a face to me.
Battling with Heyman.
It's like
different.
Yeah, these guys were there at the same time, and it's kind of interesting to see them go at it. But yeah, like I said, I enjoyed it. All right, the next one we got up is the Texas Tornado Tag. First of all, I should say Cornette dropped a promo right before this. It was great as well. Both guys outstanding on the mic. But let's get back to the Texas Tornado match. We had the Steiners versus the Varsity Club. Kevin Sullivan and Mike Rotundo, known as IRS in the WWF, if anybody's wondering. And this got 3 stars, and I thought it was a pretty good little match. It was a short match, and that's all it needed to be, because these Texas Tornado Tag rules, there's just so much happening, you know. It's kind of hard to I don't know. It's hard to get invested in it because, like I said, there's so much going on in these types of matches. Right. So I was happy.
And just
with
to
it
remind everybody, Texas Tornado, all four guys can be at the ring, right, you know, at the same time, and it was pretty much anything goes. It was not necessarily a no DQ match, but they got away with a lot of stuff, a lot of double teaming and all that kind of stuff. But again, you got two teams that are pretty evenly matched. Scott Steiner is really, I mean, he's almost brand new on the scene.
Right. The Steiners as a whole are a brand
really
new tag team.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, you still got to see some patented Steiner moves. You know, you got to see the Steiner line and some other things. And so it was a good match. I was a little surprised at how quick it went, but again, I love what you're talking about as far as with the Texas Tornado. It's hard to keep up with, you know, and that's a lot of physical movement for those guys. They don't get a breather on the outside. They're all four going at it the entire time. And honestly, I was surprised when I saw the length of time at 4:22 for this match, because watching it seemed longer because of all the constant action.
Right. It's kind of hard to grasp everything that was going on. I thought this match was, you know, it was just decent. So at this point in the pay-per-view, though, I'm like, man, I can't believe so many people consider this the greatest pay-per-view of all time. And I think it's right around this time I start to kind of see a little bit with Sting and Muta anyways. This Muta's brand new into the company. Of course, he's from Japan. He's attacked Sting. He's aligned himself with Gary Hart, who's also aligned with Terry Funk. So you have that. And Muta is like something, the first time I saw him, I remember thinking, like, there is nobody like this guy. There is nobody doing the moves that this guy does. He was just a very intriguing character to me. I liked him as a heel, but, you know, he did well as a face as well. But
and you're right, he did.
And having Gary as his mouthpiece was excellent. Gary's very underrated as a manager. You know, I would probably put him in my top five. Gary was very, very good. Gary Hart is very criminally underrated. He's very, very good.
Oh, absolutely. Well, so many modern day fans have they barely even heard of the guy. I mean, because he was so dominant in the 70s and the 80s. And so a lot of people, you know, that are younger than you are just not familiar with him whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but yeah, I think you're right. I don't think he gets his due.
It's the first person I ever saw do
was around the new color
moonsault.
Oh yeah. Muta was just, like you say, he was something so different than what we had seen before. And you know, when he goes across and he does the tumbling run across the ring and, you know, does the backflip and springs into somebody into the corner,
Yeah. That
was amazing. I love every Muta match I see, that's the one thing I wait for him to do, because that is absolutely his my favorite move that he does, even more so than the moonsault.
The springboard elbow I like a lot. And then there's a certain way he drops an elbow onto his opponents that I've always enjoyed.
Yes.
It's like a really quick, sudden, I don't know, anybody that's seen Muta in action knows exactly what I'm talking about. But it's the way he drops his elbow.
It's what the people's elbow should have been.
Yeah. And it looks like a real elbow drop. And then, of course, the submissions, the surfboard, and all that. This match is going to end in a double pin. Always kind of a fan of this finish when they kind of dust it off and they hadn't used it in a while. Kind of works here because, you know, trying to push Sting is like one of your main faces, other than Flair, who would end up switching heel to face a million times. But you're trying to push Muta as one of your main heels, and he's just came in. You can't have him lose. At the same time, you got Sting in there. You want to keep him strong. So, this finish was fine with me. It could have been a little bit better, but either way, I enjoyed the match, and it didn't ruin the match for me, the finish.
Well, you got to remember that, you know, Sting has just, and again, just to kind of to piggyback on what you already said, Sting had just come off of the Clash, you know, the 45-minute Iron Man match with Flair, you know, where they went to the where it went to the judges and it was right. a draw. You know, that was in 88. And like you say, they're just Sting has just really started a lot of momentum in the push. But if you remember, the announcers are talking about as the match goes on between Sting and Muta, mm-hmm. that Muta has never been pinned in the NWA before. He's never right. been pinned. He's never been pinned. He's not been pinned in WCW, you know, since he's been here. Da 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 da.
Yeah, they pushed
that. So,
right,
yeah, I, again, I think you've got that, again, you've got that double pin, so to speak. But then they also kind of give Sting the favor because when they go back and they look at it, it actually kind of looks like Sting got his shoulder up on the count of two. At least that was what the announcers were trying to push to you when they go back and do the replay.
Oh, I
and
love
of course,
controversial
Muta Steel,
finishes.
You know, quote,
just,
yeah.
You know
and,
what I mean?
And Muta steals the belt and runs out with it, which I would have kind of liked to seen a little more reaction from Sting with Muta running off of the belt. But when if knowing what we know now about the way the show ends, I have no problem with the way that particular match ended.
Yeah, and like I said, and it sets up another match between Muta and Sting. So, you know, of course,
sure.
I got no problems with that because those two could, I mean, they were awesome. They had good chemistry together. And, you know, Sting, that's another thing I have wrote down. Sting's leap into the second ring onto Muta. Unfreaking believable,
yes.
man. The athleticism and the
yes.
height that Sting could get behind jumping, man. I mean, this guy... When I was a kid, he was like a superhero.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even and I was a good bit older. I mean, I was in my 20s at this yeah. point, my late 20s at this point, by 89, and I loved the guy, and I still do to this day. You know how I feel about Sting.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, he's definitely
I've
one of your favorites.
I've not made any secret about that.
Right.
But absolutely, and I'm glad you said that because again. You know, that and that was the very opening move of the match because Gary Hart took Muta into the second ring and didn't want to come into the official ring. So
right.
Sting just took the fight to him by leaping
yeah.
over two sets of ropes.
Sting
was,
always did
great.
That in his matches, too. It's like the heel would back up and things
oh, yeah.
like, or I'm just coming at you. I can remember the Cactus
yeah.
Jack
Go
match
ahead,
we reviewed. He did the same thing in that match.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That was a good one. That was
Definitely.
That was a
great
pay-per-view. We reviewed if anybody wants
yes.
to go back and watch that. It was yeah, that was a good show. The Ricky Steamboat, Rick Rude, Iron Man, I recommend you go back and watch that from
yes.
Bash It or what it was called Beach Bash or something, wasn't it? It wasn't Bash
Beach
at the Beach
Bash.
Yet.
Yeah.
yeah. Beach
right.
Bash
yeah, it was Beach
90.
Bash, and that was the
Was it 91 or 92?
91?
I think
it's
92.
It was one or the other. I think so. But yeah, that's the Pin Falls Count Anywhere match between Cactus Jack and Sting that, you know, that Cactus Jack, you know, would later reflect back on as one of his greatest matches ever.
Yeah, underrated.
And, yeah.
Mm, yeah, that was a good one. Well, after that, we've got War Games, oddly, at Great American Bash, which I'm sure the fans didn't mind one bit, but I thought it was odd to see here. We've got...
Oh, wait a minute. Did we skip Luger and Steamboat?
Oh, we did skip... Oh, my bad. We did skip Luger and Steamboat.
That's okay.
That went... let's see here. 16 minutes and 27 seconds. That was...
I think that's right, yeah.
And Luger at the time is a face, right?
No, actually, Luger had just gone heel. And I've got it... I'm showing it at about 10.5 minutes.
Let me look here. Yeah. Hold on a second. I think I'm getting mixed
Luger
up
had,
the next match. That was 22 minutes. Okay. No, go ahead.
Luger had on heel. I'm trying to think. What was it that led to his heel turn? I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to go back and look for a second.
And Steamboat and Flair had just came off the their three matches, their three legendary matches. That pretty much turned
right.
Flair face because those matches were just so good. and he ended up coming out
right
the better at the third match. I think Steamboat.
Well, and I know what it was because Luger was starting to complain because Terry Funk had the championship match in this one.
Right.
Steamboat had gotten the championship match up against Flair in the previous, you know, couple of big events.
Yeah, and Luger was being pushed heavily at the time.
Right. And Luger was bad mouthing, you know, the fact that he should be the number one contender and all this kind of stuff. And it was after Clash of the Champions in June. Funk and Steamboat had a match, and Luger and Funk got disqualified in that match because he hit Steamboat with a microphone. And so Luger comes in to save Steamboat from Funk,
right?
And then turns on Steamboat, and that's when he made his heel turn.
Ah,
and so he was actually a heel, and that's what set up this match. And so this was really his big debut, I guess, if you really think about it, as a heel. And I don't know about you, but personally, I liked Luger as a heel, and I think I probably liked him better as a heel than I did as a face.
Yeah, in real life, he was a heel. From what everybody has said, he was full of himself, was just more to his true character. And then, you know, I'm sure Steamboat carried this match. Was Luger's not ever been known as like a strong worker? I think Luger's best matches are with guys who have carried him, such as Flair, Steamboat, Sting.
Agreed.
But yeah, I mean, Luger was just kind of, he was the powerhouse. Did he join the Horsemen around this time, or had he already joined the Horsemen and was out of the Horsemen?
I want to say it was later that he joined the Horsemen. I don't think he
maybe
had joined
maybe
the Horsemen.
It was because they are always
later.
Trying to redo the Horsemen.
Right. I want to say it was early 90s when he joined the Horsemen.
Yeah, it was sometime that.
No, I take that back.
Maybe he goes back to face. I want to say he goes back to being a face, and then he turns heel for his giant run.
No, this was already. Yeah.
When Harley Race was his manager.
This was past his time. He joined the Horsemen in
87, 86?
I think 88. 87, 88, something like that. So, yeah. Okay, I was thinking it was later, but no, I guess it was earlier. So, yeah, you know, and he did. He flip-flopped between heel and face. I won't say a lot, but at least early on, he did it a good bit.
Yeah, it's like they saw money in him, and then they decided to say, you know what, this guy's better as a heel.
Right. And he could draw heat pretty well. And honestly, I think people were probably more comfortable booing him than they were cheering.
Probably so.
And again, I think it goes back to his work ethic and his. I won't even say his work ethic. I'll say his abilities in the ring. I think that made him, with the lack of coordination he had as a pure wrestler, I think his skill set was better suited to a heel.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree totally with that. I mean, he just looked like a cocky heel. Steamboat, Steamboat carries him here in this one. Steamboat does not get the win in this one, or does not get the title in this one.
Right. Well, and that was the thing going into it. It had been set up as a no DQ match, and that's one of the things is that early on, before this match even started, Luger came out and did a promo where he's saying that he'll walk out. He's not gonna. He won't wrestle the match unless Steamboat agrees to drop the no DQ.
Yeah.
And then when the match actually starts, he states that again. Steamboat at first refuses, but then Steamboat being Steamboat, you know, if that's what I have to do to get the match, then that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
And so he does drop the no DQ stipulation, and then, of course, he winds up getting DQ'd because Luger gets a chair, Steamboat takes it away from him and starts using it on Luger, you know, getting his frustrations out. the ref turns and see, you know, classic ending. The ref turns and sees him and he gets disqualified. And then he chases Luger out of the, basically out of the ring with the chair.
And so, you've got the little old lady behind the TV just screaming at her TV.
Oh, of course you do. Of course you do.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got the little ladies, you know, you got the old folks sitting right there at ringside that are just cheering him on, you know, beat the crap out of Luger. That was what they came to see.
Yeah, and I was fine with that finish, too. I thought it was kind of, it is interesting to see Steamboat and Luger work together because their paths didn't cross a lot, it seemed like. Or if it did, they were in different feuds and stuff. But, I thought this match was all right.
Yeah, it was okay. And like you say, and thank God Steamboat was there to carry Luger.
Right. But Steamboat could carry anybody at the time.
Sure, no argument at all.
Yeah, Luger, on the other hand, not so much.
Right.
Well,
got the War Games match.
Right, that's right. And before we get to War Games, let's talk about the Dapper Gentleman. Let's talk about some new cigars you got down there.
Yeah, anything? I mean, in the last few months, we've been able to pretty much double our inventory. We got another cabinet humidor in, so we've probably got between 35 and 40 different offerings of cigars right now, and so a wide range of stuff from infused cigars, mild cigars, some great medium and full-bodied cigars all across the board. Some of the names that people are very familiar with, Camacho and CAO and Perdomo, and then we've got some stuff that's newer on the market, Mombacho and Cavalier and some of those guys.
Yeah, Dad will be there, of course.
Absolutely. Well, in fact, he came in not too long ago before we went on vacation and picked up some cigars. Unfortunately, I wasn't there to see him, but...
That's unfortunate. Yeah, you weren't able to see his beach body that he had prepared.
Man, I'm telling you what, he is rocking the dad bod something fierce, let me just tell you.
It's the granddad bod now.
Well, yeah, that's it.
Eating oysters, smoking cigars, drinking on the beach, talking to random strangers.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it was...
Absolutely.
It was interesting. Yeah, I love it. Yep.
I can only imagine going on vacation with him.
Oh, yeah. It was quite the treat. I wonder what he would have thought about this War Games match we have coming up here.
Well, you know, we've got to do that sometime. We've got to tape him into a chair and make him watch one of these pay-per-views.
My God. Look, God damn, he didn't even hit him that time. Well, we could probably talk him into watching some old British Bulldog Repo Man matches. He loved the over-the-top gimmick stuff.
Oh yeah, that's true. I could see that. So yeah, we just buy him some beer, and I'll give him a couple of cigars, and we'll get him to sit through a pay-per-view with us at some point.
We've got to record that.
Yeah, and then we'll just have to record it. That'll
be
the best.
We'll record it on a podcast. It's like a non-wrestling fan's reaction to an older pay-per-view.
Hear, hear.
Oh man,
I like it.
That'll get a ton of downloads.
Yeah.
We got the we got the Road Warriors and Midnight Express against the Freebirds and the Samoan SWAT team. Samoan SWAT team, I hardly remember. To me, there's something missing at this pay-per-view, and I figured it out. Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, they had left to go to WWF.
Right.
I think they saw the writing on the wall at the time with Jim Herd coming into power. But it's just so strange not to see them here at War Games and competing against other tag teams, because they just fit. Fit in with WCW and NWA. You know what? And Jim Crockett
War Games, and you don't see any of the Horsemen, and you don't see Dusty Rhodes, and so it was just like, wow, is this really a War Games setup?
Yeah, and Dusty's over there. He's in WWF too at the time.
Right. He's the common man over there, and the
polka dots.
Arn and Tully are the brain busters,
right.
And it left a big vacuum. And one name that you didn't throw in is Dr. Death was in there with the Midnight Express and the Road Warriors. And that was just weird too, is again, and we talked about this earlier, is you've got the Midnight Express
who are heels
as faces in this.
Teaming with the Road Warriors. Yeah. It was bizarre to watch, and it wasn't a bad War Games. I'm not saying it's a bad War Games. It was just very strange to see these teams feuding, I guess. Freebirds were kind of...
Right.
They were kind of on the downward spiral, I guess, of their career. They were... I think they had already reached their heyday in the mid-'80s, in the early 80s.
Oh, I wouldn't argue with that a bit.
They could still work.
Jay Gordy's... And it did, and Terry Gordy's back with them, and that was fun, you know, knowing Gordy and Williams' history with each other,
right?
You know, with their time in Japan and everything else, to see them hating each other,
right?
And they really
would team a little bit later in the early 90s, if you remember. We've actually reviewed the event that they fought the Steiners,
yes,
to a draw at Beach Bash.
Great match, yeah.
And this is a little bit before Cowboy Bill Watts had came in. Flair's handling the booking here. Road Warriors, Midnight Express, and Dr. Death Steve Williams are going to pick up the win in 22 minutes and 18 seconds. Not a bad War Games match. Very strange, again, to see these teams facing off and to see War Games at Great American Bash.
Well, and I don't know about you, but I was cringing a little to see, you know, when Hulk... gorgeous Jimmy Garvin in that backwards cradle or whatever they called it, the hangman's neck breaker.
He
cradled his chin and stretched him up over his back, and I'm thinking that's got to be a little painful, even though Jimmy Garvin, you know, was holding on and supporting himself, but then he had to let go with one hand to basically tap out to signal to the referee that he was giving up. And I'm thinking, man, that's got to be putting some strain on his.
All right, we had a little bit of technical difficulties. Had some bad weather in my area as we were recording this. But as the professor was so rudely interrupted, he was talking about how Hawk was really, 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 like, rearing back on the neck breaker, whatever you want to call that move. I don't know what it was, but he just had him. He was just like hanging him by the neck, and that's how they got the submission. Yeah. Correct?
I think the actual. Well, I think it's called a couple of different things. I mean, I've heard it called a reverse neck breaker, and I've also seen it referred to as a hangman's neck breaker. I mean, basically, he's got gorgeous Jimmy Garvin stretched across his back. They're back to back, and Hawk's got his hands reached back behind him and hooked under Garvin's neck, and then he bends over and he's just lifting Garvin up, and he's just supporting him basically by his chin.
And you don't see that nowadays. That's why it's kind of hard to explain. I mean, I don't think I've seen it much at all, really. It just looked brutal.
I don't know that I've ever seen it other than that one time. I mean, in all the wrestling that I've ever watched, I don't recall ever seeing that before. And anyway, I'm sure it's probably something they had pre-planned. I can't imagine that, you know, especially considering that end of the match, I can't imagine that's just something that Hulk just pulled out of his hip pocket and decided to throw in there.
Well, they continue to make the Road Warriors look really, really strong, and Dr. Death, Steve Williams, who I think they had pretty big plans for there for a while, but... for one reason or another, it just seemed like plans had always kind of fell through for Dr. Death, it seemed like. But had some, like, he had some star potential, something about him. Maybe he wasn't great on the mic, but, I mean, he was just a beast.
Well, and he was, and he had a lot of charisma in the ring. I mean, you know, and like you said, I mean, he was strong as an ox. A standout college athlete.
And you still don't see, and it's kind of ahead of its time, that Oklahoma Stampede where he picks the guy up in a power slam position and then runs him into the turnbuckle, which I don't know. I can't remember if we saw that in the War Games match, but that's always been a cool little spot.
Oh, it absolutely is. And, you know, and he had a great amateur background, so, you know, he could always throw that in. And you know, much like the Steiners and Rotunda and some of those other guys. And I always enjoyed watching him, and I wish that, you know, I think he would have made a great heavyweight champion at some point. But like you say, it just never really worked out, and that's a shame for him, and I think for us as fans.
Yeah, timing can be everything, especially in wrestling. So, but I mean, that was JR's boy, man. JR, he's from Oklahoma, and that's always been his boy. He tried to push him in WWE as well. That's another podcast, right, though.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to move on to the main event. Went 17 minutes and 23 seconds. This is the main event that sold me on the pay-per-view. This main event was really, really good. I love the reverse cradle. We talked about this at length a little bit last night. What did you think of this match?
I thought it was great. I mean, it was balls to the wall from the get-go. You know, Terry Funk set himself up as just a wild. I mean, he always had that reputation as being very unpredictable. And from the moment they introduced him, he was jumping over the barricade out into the crowd, threatening people in the crowd. You never knew what he was going to do.
And you know what set this up, and we haven't even talked about, was that when Flair completed the trilogy with Steamboat and he was respected by fans, Funk was interviewing Flair, and then he attacked him and gave him the pile driver on the table, which Flair had to support himself. It was a terrible looking pile driver on the table. But at the time, you didn't see people being pile drived, you know, into tables in 89.
And you're right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, and so I think it was a great setup for this match. And, you know, it's automatic heat, whether you've ever seen the guys or not. If anything about Funk, and if you know anything about Flair, I mean, it's going to be a great match just because they're so able to entice the crowd into the match. And Funk was just, you know, I think we talked about this, you know, it's the times are rare that Flair can come across as a babyface. And this was definitely one of those times.
Yeah, and Funk did his job. They both played their role really well. Funk being a perfect heel in this situation. If you can get Flair over as a face, which, I mean, he was starting to get over with the crowd, especially after the Steamboat matches. But Funk was a perfect heel to go against a babyface Nature Boy.
Oh, there's no question about it. You know, because the times are few and far between that anybody can ever consider Funk a baby face. And, you know, and this one was just, it was a great freaking match. A lot of good bumps, a lot of good moves, a lot of good action. And, I mean, it was a solid, solid match from beginning to end, I thought. And, you know, and then it winds up with Gary Hart and the great Muda showing up to, you know, to attack Flair after they do the, you know, after the roll up small package reversal that Flair pulls on Funk to win the match.
And that's when the crowd comes in glued, and then you see Muda come out Sting for the save after everything he's been through with Flair. People didn't probably think, well, he probably won't come out, but since he already had a feud with Muda, that tied in well. And I love the ending of this pay-per-view. And, you know, according to Cornette, it was high fives in the back after the pay-per-view. They were on a downward trend, and the house show business was in the shits. And, you know, they weren't making much money. But after this pay-per-view, they were, you know, they were pretty pleased.
And they should be, because I think this card, and we talked about this earlier in the program, you know, some people have claimed this to be the best, certainly the best WCW pay-per-view of all time, if not the greatest pay-per-view of all time. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly debatable. Everybody's going to have their opinion on that.
Right.
It was a good show, and the ending of it, again, as we talked about, it was wide open until they went off the air because, you know, Funk and Muda kept coming back. You know, Flair's bleeding. I mean, he was already bleeding before the match ended, you know, which is very typical.
and then he gets sprayed, you know, by Muda and all this crap that's going on at the end. And I mean, he's just, nobody did that crazed look like Flair when he's giving an interview, when he's all hyped up and he's pissed off, and he's got his hair streaked with blood, his face is streaked with blood, his face is green, it's this mixture of blood and that green mist that Muda was known for, and Flair's just, his hair's all wild and he's just going crazy.
Yeah, I love it.
And oh, it was one of the best moments, I think. Certainly, for me, it would be a top 10 on mic moment of all time, just because of the way he carried it and his abs and his look for it. For me, that's what sold it.
Yeah,
completely.
And
so,
Dave
yeah,
Meltzer,
I think it was a great match.
And I forgot to mention, Dave Meltzer gave this a 4.75 stars review, which is high praise from Dave Meltzer. He's very picky on his matches. But,
right.
Yeah, I would rate this event, I would give it 4 stars because of the main event and Sting and Muda. And I enjoyed Cornette personally and Heyman. Some people might not like it. But, yeah, I enjoyed that. Let's see here. Looking over my notes, you know, the tornado tag match was okay. It was good for what it's worth. Let's see here. The battle royal was intriguing. I just didn't like the ending all that well.
Yeah.
I understand where it was trying to go, but that one was just kind of eh. But they did a good job. I think Flair booked this show, Flair and Cornette and a number of others, and they got it good here.
Oh, I agree. I think they hit on just about every single match, and like we said, the ending for the Battle Royal, it could have been a lot better, but at the same time, they had to get the skyscrapers over, and I think that was a good way to do it. They had to set Teddy Long up as begin to show that he's at least a little bit of a mastermind manager, and so you know he got to step in and declare both his guys as the co-winners, and so I think they established that. You and I are huge marks for the Steiners, and this was our first real heavy-duty introduction to the Steiner brothers as a tag team, and so that's always going to get a warm spot in my heart.
Absolutely,
and I'm like you, I'm giving it at least a 4, if not maybe 4.25, 4.5, just simply because of the way it tugs at my heart because of the Steiner brothers.
I think the
and,
professor
you know,
needs
and
to
I'm
give
a,
it.
I'm a huge Sting guy too.
Yeah, and the professor needs to give it a grade. What would you give it? A, B, C.
I think it's an A. I definitely think it's an A. It may not be an A plus, but it's a solid A minus or an A. No doubt about it.
Yeah, I would have to go with an A plus on this, 100%. It was pretty awesome. Hey, Andrew, I want to thank you for being on the podcast tonight, man, and reshooting
hey,
a little
buddy,
bit of this.
Pleasure.
And this was for the 200 members that joined up recently. I appreciate it, and me and Andrew appreciate it. And we'll be back for another podcast soon. We'll put up a poll, and we'll see you then. Thanks, Andrew.
Sounds great. Thanks.
See you, buddy.
Bye.
Bye.
Baltimore, 9 October, on the 23rd of July, 1985. going to come down to one match on July 23rd.
We like it, we love it, and we're going to have more of it. Dead before